Hello, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, college football fans across the nation and around the world. This is Tim May with the Tim May Podcast, the hottest aptly named podcast out there. Correct, Awesome Ward?
Yeah, it's like you took the blurb, my recommendation for this podcast, and just read it word for word.
Yeah, well, that's the way I work, man. If you can steal somebody else's work, why not do it? You know, plus, you know, the beginning of this podcast, I know, has turned into a perpetual pat myself on the back that I'm actually back for another week. But, you know, we've been doing this now for almost 2 years, and I've totally enjoyed it. Same thing today, man. This week's version, I've got one of my favorite people of all time. I say that every time I have somebody on.
Well, this guy definitely is. Hey, you love people, and there's nothing wrong with that.
I know, but I like, you know, I just think about it a lot. I've been blessed, man. I've run into a lot of quality folks, man, being a sports writer all those years and stuff. And guys, man, you just really, you see them grow up. You know, like I've always said, if I had 10 bucks for everybody I knew as a football player or a race car driver or somebody who ended up making millions, I'd have millions, you know. But some of these are really quality people. And Kirk Herbstreit, I definitely count in that group. And I've got him on this week's podcast talking about the book he's going to have coming out later this year that was co-written. Pretty much Gene Wojciechowski did most of the legwork, I'm sure, the typing work on it, but yeah. With Gene Wojciechowski. But it's a look into Kirk Herbstreit's, you know, growing up, you know, the pats on the back you get sometimes, but also the pangs of becoming a success, and then how much family is important to you, et cetera, you know. And I haven't read the book yet. I haven't gotten a copy of it, but I got the gist of it. But he and I started talking. And of course, you know, like I said, if you put me and Kirk and you in a radio show, it would have to be a 3-hour radio show every day, because you and I and Kirk would each spend about a third of the first hour giving our first initial point, right?
I'm not sure that there would even be room for me if you two are on there. Like, I'm barely going to squeeze into this week's show.
Well, maybe we could promo the second hour with it coming up in hour two. Awesome Ward makes his point.
After I've soaked in everything that you two had to say.
Yeah, but we got into like present day football, you know, where the NIL is going, national, you know, the name, image, and likeness, the one-time transfer portal situation that's coming. I mean, even though that's kind of what they've got already, you know, when you think about it, but just how it's kind of changed the whole, you know, hootenanny of major college football. But, you know, before that, I wanted to touch base with you and anything going on with the Ohio State beat that was interesting to you over the past week that's going to roll into this week that you've got your eye on?
Been pretty quiet, I'd say, for the most part, yeah. Tim. I mean, I think that you see what's happening with some ticket sales for the NCAA basketball tournament, the Big Ten basketball tournament. Maybe we'll see what that means for potentially the spring game. I know initially – the last time I had talked to Gene Smith, it didn't sound like that was really going to be an option. But now that you look at the state guidelines having changed in Ohio, the governor starting to, you know, I've got tickets to go see the Blue Jackets this week. I didn't think that was going to happen this year either. So, you know, that stuff, maybe we'll see what happens now that that date has been set there in late April for the Buckeyes. I don't want to get anyone's hopes, you know, too far up. There are complications that would come from trying to turn this around on short notice. It's not as easy as it might seem when when Ohio State, you know, hadn't been planning on the spring game having tickets. What would you charge the way that they normally do it? Basically, you know, anybody can come. It's not a huge money making opportunity for them. Maybe they would want it to be in this case if there was huge demand. So how would you manage that? It would sell out in probably 2 seconds. If you charge $5 or $15, the way they have in some instances in the past.
Dude, let me interrupt you. They could use the proceeds to make up for some of the shortfall from this past year. Cause you know this, you know, they're not going to open it up to 100,000 people.
No.
But if they did, it would be 100,000 people there. I do believe there's that much fervor, I think, champing at the bit of people wanting to see some semblance of Ohio State football live. You get that feeling too, don't you?
Yeah. And that's why I think that's what's interesting about it. And they're always sensitive to this. When we just talked about the season ticket policy a week ago, like they don't want to make it, they certainly don't want to make it seem like a money grab or take advantage of fans who've been waiting a long time, but there are also difficult balancing acts if you would only have 15 or 20,000 people in the horseshoe. You know, are all those going to be open to the public? How would you manage the secondary market, which I think would probably explode for a spring game, which sounds crazy, probably another program in the country, but would definitely be the case here, I think, for Ohio State. Some nice weather and a quarterback battle, and the fact that the shoe was empty all of last year. But I think that that's sort of one of the things to keep watching here. Ohio State's, I think that there might be some, firming up of plans with Oregon and trying to find a second date. You know, so it's really, it's scheduling stuff. It's ticketing stuff, I think, right now, just trying to get through all this and for some spring ball to start a week from Friday. We can talk about that. So stuff that I think is, there's not a bunch of like immediacy going on right now, but I think that's good because we're getting back to some sense of normalcy a little bit.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I was stumped, you and I, been doing this podcast throughout the pandemic, et cetera. And I remember last spring, I pointed out to folks, this hole that was, that's been burned into every major college athletic department's finances over the last year is never going to be totally refilled. It's basically, and a lot of people have done a lot of trimming since then, but there will be ways for them to make up some of the difference. Cause you eventually an athletic department is like a race car. A lot of people think a race car runs on gasoline. It runs on greenbacks. It runs on American dollars. And, or if you're in Europe, whatever that is, the euro, but the same thing with an athletic department, it runs on money. And we can debate the merits of this, that, and the other, and whether you're getting ripped off or whatever, if the market's there, it behooves you for the most part to take advantage of it. And I think Ohio State, in my opinion, they've been late to this party, I don't know if you agree or not. And we touched on that last week in last week's podcast. They included a conversation with Jim Lachey. If they could have gotten the act together to have a spring game this year, they could have made up a lot of difference. But, hey, we'll talk about that later. I want to get into my conversation with Kirk and then come back. And it's kind of a long conversation, but I think it's very interesting. And then come back and you and I touch on a couple other subjects. You can stick around, right?
I'm not going anywhere.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, without further ado, my conversation with Kirk Herbstreit. And as promised, ladies and gentlemen, welcoming Kirk Herbstreit back to the Tim May podcast. How you doing, Kirk?
I'm doing good, bud. How are you?
I'm doing great, man. I talked to you a couple of times last year. Appreciate you coming on my podcast. Any chance you get, any chance I get to have you on, you're always, well, everybody knows who you are. But everybody knows your expertise, et cetera. But, the reason I got you on today is, I got this alert last week by email that you've got a book coming out that you co-wrote with Gene Wojciechowski, one of the great journalists we've had covering college football for a long, long time. And I just wanted to jump right into that real quick. What was the spur that got you going on wanting to get something out there book-wise?
I've been asked by a number of people over the years to potentially write a book, and I've never obviously written one. I didn't know all that went into it, and I just put it on the back burner. I just never really thought maybe when I retired I'd maybe look at it. Gene came to me about a year or two ago and asked me if I had any interest in doing it. I kind of told him the same thing. I said, man, maybe, down the road. And if I do, I'd love for you to be involved because I have such respect for him.
Yeah.
And so, it was almost like a year ago right now when COVID really hit and everybody just kind of quarantined and shut down. And, in my case, my boys came back from Clemson. My other two boys were already here. This is back when it first started, how are we going to get groceries? Nobody was going anywhere.
Yeah.
You didn't really leave your house, there for a few weeks. And he called me about a week or two after that and said, hey, would you have any interest in maybe revisiting it? And I don't know why. I just said, yeah. I said, who knows what's going to happen tomorrow? Who knows what's going on with our lives right now? Let's maybe look at it and let's talk about what we'd want to do. Cause there's a variety of different themes you could do. You could do a year, a season of College Game Day. You could you could do a lot of different things, you know, coaches, players. But we just decided to talk a little bit about where my life started and, you know, basically in Trotwood, Ohio, and just kind of go through, you know, some of my life lessons and some of the trials and tribulations that I've lived through, not just as an athlete, but coming from a divorced family and having a lot of dysfunction within my family that I've had to endure, and how I managed that, and, you know, being painfully shy. You know, when I first sat down with you, by then I'd played high school quarterback, and I had some experience with guys like Chick Ludwig at the Dayton Daily News and some of the local TV stations. So I at least had gotten some reps, but I'm talking about if they asked me to stand up in fifth grade and give a speech, that was like the worst possible thing you could do to me. Like, so just to go from that to now I speak in front of millions of people on an average fall weekend with college football. So it's just a lot on just my journey. And then of course we get into the sports part of it as well.
Yeah. You know, and you got, I think you got a lot of family stuff in there too, like you pointed out, you know, and I'm just wondering, was having all your family kind of back under one roof, was that kind of a spur too? Because I would think at this moment in your life, you know, you're always going to get criticism if you talk too bad about Alabama or Ohio State or Texas or somebody. You understand what I'm saying?
Yeah.
But having them all under one roof, and how just, I don't know if lucky's not, but blessed your life has been, especially from a family situation, your own family. I mean, it's kind of, it gives you goosebumps a little bit, doesn't it?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I was about eight. I think I was about 8 years old. My family, my mom and dad got a divorce. And then, you know, I went to a different school almost every year. I think I ended up going from second grade to ninth grade. I think I went to a new school about every year, with just a lot of different moves. My mom remarried. I went from Trotwood to Centerville to Franklin, Ohio, to Cincinnati, Wyoming, back to Centerville. And for a guy who's really shy, that's a really hard thing to manage. And then my ninth grade year, my mom and my dad decided to move in together after all that. They'd both been remarried and divorced, and full circle, came back, and just as friends, not to be a couple, but just for me to have some semblance of normalcy. They decided for my high school years to live together. And they did, you know, it was amazing experience for me after going through a lot of that, you know, that some of the headaches that I went through from third, fourth grade all the way, you know, into high school.
Dude, that's crazy though. I mean, that's crazy. Like you just pointed out a while ago, to think about you afraid to stand up in a fifth or sixth grade class, maybe even to say your name, you know,
terrified. I don't know, man. I don't know. I'd ask you, I think you're born with that. You know, I think you're either, I don't know.
Agree.
Maybe I feel like you're born as an introvert, you know, and I'm just an introvert by nature. That's just how I'm wired. And so when you're that way, you know, the only time I would ever open up is if I was within my circle of buddies. Yeah. Then I feel like I could be myself and not worry about it. But if I didn't know the people in a room, or I wasn't real comfortable with them, and I had to stand up, my face would get immediately red, and I just feel heat.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and it's more of an uncomfortable feeling than anything, almost, I guess, like social anxiety. The only way I really got through it was talking to guys like you and doing interviews and getting comfortable being uncomfortable, you know, and I think doing it rep after rep after rep after rep. By the time I was a senior at Ohio State, and I would sit there and I'd have, you know, you were there, there'd be anywhere from 15, 20, 30 reporters around me with all these cameras and microphones and, you know, the old cassette tapes that you guys would have.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, everyone was just pointed at me. And I got to a point where I was really comfortable doing that, you know, which was really a turning point, I think, for me, on a personal level, because I still wasn't comfortable giving necessarily a speech, but I could at least get up and talk about, hey, John Cooper thinks this or that, or what do you think about playing Michigan or Syracuse or whatever. I could at least stand up and be confident and be comfortable talking about whatever we were talking about. And for me, that was a long way from where I was, years before that.
Yeah. But at least by then, finally and blessedly, you'd been named the starting quarterback at Ohio State. You know, we all went through, we could talk forever. Well, that'd be another.
I tell you, man, the hardest part was being honest about Elliot Usalak and Ron Hudson in the book. I feel like, and Gene taught me this, like, I've always been a guy that tries to say the right thing. I've always been a guy that's tried to, I just don't believe in, going after people. And I had to be honest about that 1990, 1991. A lot of it was me, a lot of it was on me and my skill level and where I was. But, I wouldn't wish those two on my worst enemy as far as their style and how they handled players. And I was honest, about them. So,
yeah, I was going to say, man, you lived through the Robert Smith episode and everything else. And there was a lot going on there behind the scenes. I had several coaches on that staff who took a while for them to ever like me again. Cause we were writing about stuff that was right in front of you and stuff, but it's really funny. Ron Hudson, I remember Nick Cochran threw a touchdown pass in the spring game one year. And I went down and got to talk to all you guys way back then. Remember? And I said, yeah, what'd you think about that? He was mad at Nick Cochran for throwing that pass. And I go, why are you mad? He goes, well, that won't be open in a real game. I just went, what in the hell is he talking about? Poor Nick.
A really quick story that we actually put in the book. So my senior year, you'll remember this. We opened up with Louisville home game. Students weren't on campus yet. Yeah. And you know how it is at Ohio Stadium when the students aren't on campus and you're playing a team you're supposed to beat. It's kind of a flat atmosphere. And we did
low-key affair. Yeah.
Yeah. We did just enough. And they were actually a good team. Jeff Brohm was the quarterback. We did just enough to hold on to beat them. The next week, we played Gary Blackney in Bowling Green. Bowling Green ended up, I think, 10-1 that year. They were a really good team. We lose Galloway to an ACL. We lose Alan Klein. Robert Smith cracks ribs. I mean, I hurt my ankle.
Yeah.
We had a lot of problems go on, but we just get through Bowling Green. So we at home beat Louisville, at home beat Bowling Green. We're basically getting booed, off the field at our own stadium, and we're 2-0, and we're going to Syracuse, and nobody gives us a chance to play Syracuse. They're a top 5 or top 10 team.
Well, I mean, not only that, but they had beaten you guys in the Outback Bowl the previous year. Yeah.
Almost the whole team was back, Marvin Graves and that kind of group. And so opening drive, I can't really feel – I'm shot up pretty good on my ankle. I can't really feel my leg.
Yeah.
Opening drive, we had, through film study, seen that their free safety, when they went single high, he came down really aggressively on play action. So it was just one of those throw it up, and hope the safety comes up. There's really not a read or a check down. It's just sell the fake hard to Raymond. I think it was Raymond Harris. I think my backfield, Robert Smith, Raymond Harris, Eddie George were my
backfield. Yeah, that's pretty good. Pretty good lineup. Yeah.
So it was a hard play fake from about the 50 and just basically take two hitches and throw it as far and as high as you can. And the safety actually did not come up that far. So he was unable to get back in position, but I still was supposed to throw it up and hope that Brian Stabline can go up and make a play. And he did.
Yeah.
Stabline was so gifted as an athlete, went up and over, made a play, and we scored. And here we are supposed to get blown out. First series, we're up 7-0. And our sidelines, how when you have a chip on your shoulder because you're told you can't win a game, we were so unified that game. And I'm over the sideline and we're like, everyone's cussing and yelling. Oh, I told you we could do this. And I go over the phone. They were like, the quarterback guy said, hey, Coach Hudson wants to talk to you. I pick up the phone. I'm like, yeah, coach. Yeah, what's up? And he's like, all right. Settle down. He's like, listen, what, let's go back to that second down on that tight end, that drag. What were you thinking on that? And I go, F. I go, like, I looked at this phone and I was like, after all I'd been through with him, I go, F you. And I hung up the phone, didn't talk to him the rest of the game.
Are you kidding? You never told me that story.
Yeah. I was just like, how can you possibly? What might think of that was you saying Nick Cochran threw a touchdown pass, and you went down to say, boy, what a great throw by Nick. And he's like, oh, what's he thinking? That's not going to be open in a game. It's like, what are you talking about?
I know, exactly. So, crazy. Surprised you survived all that. Hey, real quick, though, I did want to touch on this with you. I don't know if you touch on it in the book, but I remember talking to Gene about it because I haven't seen the book yet. But, you know, I remember like it was 5 minutes ago when you guys came trotting out for practice the day you were told Kent Graham was going to be the starting quarterback. And I remember you were, you know, y'all were doing special teams warmups and you were catching the snaps for the field goal. And I already knew, no offense, I was a really good reporter back then. I already knew what you'd been told, you know, but I could see it. And I just watched you and I just watched the disappointment. You know, you catch a snap and you put it down and you kind of looked at the ground and stuff. Yeah. How tough was that to go through as an athlete? You know, you were this superstar coming into Ohio State. Really, you were. You were that first big commitment to John Cooper and stuff. But how tough was that year to year to year being told you weren't the guy they wanted to lead the team? And then compare that with the exaltation you had when you were finally told you were that. And that's, I'm sure that's maybe a lesson you touch on in the book or at least go through.
Yeah, I mean, I came in, when I signed, it was like, oh, we got this Herb Street kid out of Centerville. He's going to start for 4 years, lead the Rose Bowls. It was that kind of feeling. And I'll be honest with you, I was coming out of a triple option attack, wishbone attack, and all my movements were down the line and reading, you know, the front. Yeah. And all of a sudden I play in Jim Coletto's offense, and it's like a West Coast offense. We're dropping back. And it's one thing to think how you think as an 18, 19, and 20-year-old. It's another thing to think about it when you look back and think about it 30 years later. And I'll be really honest with myself, and I always am. I wasn't ready. I wasn't ready to play as a freshman. And it was a humiliating experience when you come in with those kind of expectations and you are perceived to fall flat on your face. And I was – my wheels were spinning. You know, I was – those first two or three years, I was getting just very, very cynical. I was getting upset. I was down to myself. I wanted to give up on the game. I wanted to go play baseball. I just didn't want to do it anymore. By my third year, we played Air Force that year in a bowl game. And that was like my one saving grace, is that we ran Air Force's offense in high school. So I requested to go back down on the scout team for the Air Force game so I could run that triple option to try to get our defense ready, and had a lot of fun and a lot of success that bowl prep getting ready. But I'd really mentally already checked out, you know. Wow. If I'm being, again, honest, I was done. After my third year, Jim Coletto, you know, it would go on to leave, but he was just a lot to deal with for me. He's kind of a smart ass type of guy.
Yeah.
And when you weren't living up to the expectations, he was tough to deal with. And so I went to my dad, who played at Ohio State and was a captain, coached with Woody, and told him, you know, I think this is it for me. And he didn't get upset or anything, but he encouraged me to give it another spring, that I'd come too far to give up on it. And he wanted me to kind of keep battling. And I'm glad he gave me that advice, because it wasn't like, you're not going to quit. Yeah. You don't quit. We're Herbs. It was nothing like that. It was more encouragement. It was more from love, not more out of you're an embarrassment. What are you doing? It wasn't like that at all. And so I went through the spring, and Kent Graham was there, and Joe Pickens was like the latest, you know, crown jewel coming in out of Cleveland St. Ignatius.
Yeah.
And I was kind of like that forgotten guy. Well, I worked my ass off to get better as a passer and went into it. And Ron Hudson said, listen, nobody's got a starting job. Greg Fry is gone. We're going to track every 7-on-7 throw. We're going to track every team throw. And we're going to look at those numbers. And based on that, that's how we're going to make a decision throughout spring and in the summer. So I went back to my old style. I was now invested again. I hadn't been in 3 years. Now I was back to being like, I can do this. And I really was. I was to a point where I was able to make most of the throws in our offense. And so to feel like I performed with Kent, maybe above him throughout that spring and even into summer, and then to be told you're not going to get it, it just felt it was predetermined. The thing that kept me going is guys like Bernard Edwards, guys that were on our team that really wanted me to be the guy. You know, yeah. Kent, with all due respect to Kent, he had a wife, he had a baby. He was kind of a man, a young man.
Yeah. And he had transferred there from Notre Dame, et cetera.
Go ahead. Guys, you know, like hanging out and doing stuff that we all did. He just wasn't at that stage of his life.
Yeah.
And so I had a lot of camaraderie with the fellas, you know, with the guys. And so and when I was in the huddle, man, I was talking to them like, you know, like I was like, let's do this kind of thing. And they just seemed to feed off of that. And so, you know, I got some opportunities early my junior year, Washington State, Kent got hurt. And I started against Drew Bledsoe and performed pretty well. And Kent still was kind of the guy, and he would play some and I would come in. And anyway, that went on most of the year like that. But I feel like that disappointment you're talking about is when you feel like you reinvested and you put everything into it and you performed as well. And then to be told, you know, we're going with the other guy, it was just another kick in the ribs, you know. But thankfully, my teammates, that's what really got me through that, is I was so close to becoming the guy that it wasn't like another disappointment, screw it, I'm out of here. It was, I wanted to accelerate. I wanted to push even harder because of the way my teammates were encouraging me and really making me feel like they wanted me to be the guy. And that's why I kept pushing. And then it all paid off, you know, towards the.
Oh, I was going to say, the funny thing about it was I thought Ohio State's offense had moved more toward your strengths anyway after Coletto left, because Coletto ran a pro style passing attack. You remember that? I mean, it was interesting. I mean, he was an interesting dude. That is for sure. You're right about that. But that's why I thought it was almost like, you know, because I like Kent Graham to this day. He's one of my favorite guys ever, but so are you. You know, it's really funny, but it's almost like, hey, this guy transferred in from Notre Dame, blah, blah, blah. You know, benefit of the doubt, you know, he is more of the stand in the pocket thrower, even though that's kind of like not what we're doing anymore. Yeah. But I thought it was so poetically strange or poisoning that you finally are named the starting quarterback in 1992. And then you sprain your ankle. I mean, people don't remember watching you play. You had some wheels, my friend.
Yeah.
And you had elusive moves, et cetera. And to sprain an ankle, that's like taking your left arm and tying it around your back or something, right? Did you feel that way?
Yeah. I mean, I had a high sprain, ankle sprain my entire pretty much.
Doesn't go away. Yeah.
You know, what was amazing is going back to my high school years, I watched Michigan quite a bit. And Michigan and Notre Dame in those years, when they would get into short yardage and goal line situations, they would go into a wishbone look.
Yeah.
And they would run the triple option, you know, with Jim Harbaugh and Tony Rice. And so when I was at Ohio State, finally my senior year, I went up to Joe Hollis, who took over for LA USLAC as the offense coordinator. This is before I got hurt.
Yeah.
And Jeff Cothran was a really talented tailback who had grown into a fullback. And I said, hey, coach, in early June, I said, coach, if I work with Jeff on that mesh, I said, do you think we could implement some triple option? Because you imagine a defense, it takes a whole week to get ready to defend a triple option, a true triple option. You just don't have the time. So if you're getting ready for all the other stuff we're doing, now you got to get ready for a triple in the short yardage and goal line. He goes, I love that idea. If you and Jeff work really hard and get, you know, really, really prolific at it, we'll put it in. We'll put it in those short yardage and goal line situations. I was so fired up because it was a wrinkle no one has ever heard of or seen at Ohio State.
Yeah.
It was wheelhouse for me. It was very natural for me. I just had to get Jeff. For people that don't know, on a triple option, you put, and it's really like modern football today with zone read, you put the ball into the belly of the fullback, and you're not looking at him. You're both looking at the read, usually the first defensive lineman outside of the guard. So you put that ball in there. You're looking right at him, and you kind of ride the fullback. And if that guy commits down to the fullback, to Jeff Cothran, you pull it out, and then you go to the end man on the line of scrimmage, and you would pitch off of him or fake a pitch and run. And if he stays wide, you just hand it off to Jeff. It's really, if it's run right, you can't defend it, especially if you don't spend time, you know, during your week of practice. So I got Jeff. Jeff is such a great guy. Jeff would work hard on it in the summer, and we got to a point where we were really starting to feel good about it, and we weren't going to really show it in the Louisville and Bowling Green game. And then I end up really tearing my ankle up and part of my Achilles, and I'm just trying to limp through. And so we never really could implement that part of our offense, which I think would have been a game changer, really, if I were 100% healthy and able to run it with Jeff.
I thought it was pretty funny. You know, you were all healthy your first 4 years there. Then your senior year, you get hurt. Basically, but now you're their guy. You know what I mean? Yeah, exactly. They're throwing you out there. I mean, and it's pretty funny. I mean, but then you went up because, man, I'll never forget that day, like 2 years earlier when John Cooper came walking up with you and y'all walked up to me and said, Coach Cooper said, Tim, Kirk's got something to tell you. He goes, he's going to be, I'm just paraphrasing here, but we're moving him from quarterback to safety, I think it was. Yeah. And you were like, yeah, that's, you know, you were giving me this kind of half-assed gung-ho look, you know, I'm just going, you know, and of course, I think 2 weeks later, you were back at quarterback, but you were trying to get on the field for Ohio State.
Well, right? I was, and I started to cover kickoffs and scout team, and I had so much rage and anger in me, even on the scout team kickoff coverage, to think that this is where the five-star guy 2 years later is. He's on a scout team covering kickoffs, and I was – really upset. And so I was covering these kickoffs and scout team, basically like a wedge buster, just running down. And I was a big guy. I was 6'3", 230 pounds. That could run a 4.6. So I'm running down there as hard as I can. And I'm not afraid to hit people. And I was hitting people. And then they end up saying, man, let's put him into the game and let him cover a kickoff. So I started covering kickoffs like a madman, hitting people. Now I wouldn't move to safety yet. I was still just a quarterback.
Yeah.
And then that's when John Cooper pulled me into his office after a couple games of covering kickoffs in real games, making some tackles. And he said, Herbie, you know, we love you. And we think you're a big athletic guy that we're wasting on the bench. We feel like you can help us. You know, we're going to move you over to safety. I want you to buy into that if that's something you'll consider. And I was like, yeah. At that point, I was like, man, coach, I'll do anything.
Yeah.
I just want to play. You know, I just want to play. So I went over there, and Bo Pelini was a starting free safety. God bless Bo. I mean, he was trying as best as he could to try to coach me up. And Ron Zook was a defensive back coach. And, you know, we had Benny Clark and all these really talented guys. And I'm sitting here. I hadn't played defense since I was in fifth or sixth grade. And I'm sitting there trying to, like, backpedal and do these drills. And like you said, I had bigger shoulder pads. I was wearing these red Newman gloves, you know, back in those days.
Yeah.
It lasted about a week and a half. And I was just like, you know what? I think I want to go, as much as I can't stand Ron Hudson, I think I want to go back and be a quarterback again.
But hey, listen to this, because we don't have much time left, but I just want to say, I mean, what are the lessons you kind of, in your book with Gene, you know, what are the lessons you kind of like, you think you kind of teach in there? Is it about perseverance? Is it about know who you are more, you know who you are more than the guy maybe coaching you, kind of, you know, what are sort of those lessons you kind of pass along to your four boys? I mean, you know, you've been blessed, like I said, I mean, with a great family. Just what have you kind of like pushed on them more than anything else about your athletic experience?
You know, I heard a pastor one time say, you're either in the middle of a storm, you're coming out of a storm,
or
you're heading into a storm. And I think that's just life, right?
I mean,
we live in the world of adversity as adults. And that was my first real adversity that I had to cope with and manage. And that's why when we talk about opting out, when I see players opting out and a lot of times just instantly going to another school, I can only speak on my experience. That what I went through was hell. What I went through was not easy. What I went through was embarrassing and humiliating. And yet my dad's encouragement, my dad's not you better get your ass back in there. Kind of, it wasn't that, it was encouragement
yeah.
and belief, and my teammates' belief in me got me to the other side. And so my lesson that I learned was exactly what you're talking about, is perseverance and not giving up when things go sideways, and keep doing the right thing and keep trusting it and keep working at it. And whether you end up becoming like the starter and a captain and most inspirational player, I mean, I was fortunate on the back end of my journey, all those things that happened on my back end. Yeah. But if that wouldn't have happened, I wonder where I would be, as far as, I would have been proud of myself. I think that I lived through it. I fought through it. I didn't give up. And I think because of the way my teammates and my really tight circle of family and friends, they were proud of me, you know, more than anything, because I didn't go play baseball. I didn't transfer. I got out of that cynical way of living that I was living those first 3 years. And, you know, I hope people, these players that decide, wow, the coach yelled at me, the coach made me get up at 6 a.m. this isn't the place for me, I'm going to leave. You know, I think we're really cheating these kids out to give them these automatic, basically get out of jail free card, because that's not how life's going to be.
Yeah.
You know, you're going to have differences with your boss. You're going to have differences with your wife. You're going to have differences with your children. You got to learn how to cope with those things and manage those things and work through those things. And I worry in college football right now that we're teaching kids, hey, when the going get tough, just transfer, go to another school. And so I hope more and more people will try to fight through it and keep trying to find a positive.
Yeah, you're yin my yang, man, because I was gonna dovetail right into that, you know, with the one-time transfer rule that's coming down the pike, name, image, and likeness, which is another. And I'm not knocking it, because I've always thought, you know, big time college football and basketball players do bring in revenue now, without a doubt, that wasn't there even when you were playing.
Yeah.
And there's no doubt that they should share somewhere in that pie. They should get some of the filling. You know what I mean? Yeah. But even that's getting something now that usually in the old days or whatever, you had to kind of wait on, you know, remuneration, reward, for want of another term and stuff. And I just touch on that real quick. Kirk, do you feel like this is sort of a crossroads era we're going to be going through? What's just your take on it?
I think this is the most critical time in my lifetime, maybe ever, for the sport, for the NCAA. And really, if you just take the NCAA out of it, just college football. You know, I was with Saquon Barkley the other night at an event where he and I were speaking, and we were just talking about how players are skipping bowl games, you know, not just the Blue Bonnet type of bowl, you know, that's a third or fourth tier.
Yeah.
But the Rose Bowl or the Sugar Bowl or the Orange Bowl, when they're not in the rotation. And I just feel like we, forgetting the players for a second, we, meaning you and your coverage and me and my coverage, we are all so guilty, and especially at ESPN on a national level, focusing on the playoff.
Oh, yeah.
The playoff, that we've gotten away from, like, Iowa might be playing – I don't know, Michigan, in a really interesting game as far as those two teams and where they might finish in their season. They're not close to a playoff maybe, but man, it's Iowa and it's Michigan, and it's at Kinnick, and it's a night game, and it's going to be hyped up. Like, we need to celebrate that kind of game.
Yeah.
Or Mississippi State's playing Kentucky, I don't know, and it's both these teams are off the grid as far as the playoff, but boy, for Mark Stoops and what he's building in Lexington and what's going on with Mississippi State, that's a great game. You know, I feel like we've gotten away from just celebrating the sport and just competitive games. And it's, oh, it's not about the playoff, don't worry about it, who cares? And it's like, so we have taught this generation of players that opt out, those games don't matter. The only thing that matters is the playoff. And so I really hope that we, the people that kind of set the tone and create the opinions, we'll broaden our scope and talk more about the sport and what we all love about a football Saturday in Columbus or wherever you happen to be. And we celebrate the sport, because I think we are getting these players. All the players think about is, I'm going to go to Ohio State. I'm not saying all of them, going to go to Ohio State. I'm going to go to Michigan State. I'm going to go to Florida State. 3 years. Three? Yeah, I'm going to go 3 years. Then I'm going to the NFL. In the middle of that, I'm going to get some money. And then they don't dig any roots into their school. And they don't bring their families back to the Oval and like, oh, yeah, I had a class over here. Like, there's just none of that. It's just a pit stop to go to try to get to the NFL.
Yeah.
Keep in mind, 2% make it to the NFL, and we're throwing all of our eggs into that basket. So I think we are, with name, image, and likeness, with players opting out, with players transferring, skipping bowl games, we gotta take a big step back as a sport and remember why we play college football. It's not just about going to the NFL. And I think when that's the focus and we get away from the experience and the education and the moments, I mean, 18, 19, 20, 21, 22 on a college campus.
Yeah.
Playing big time college football, a lot of times on national TV with your boys. I mean, are you kidding me? I've never interviewed an NFL player and have them say to me, man, I'm so glad I'm done with college football. I would never want to go back there again. Every guy, you've done the same thing.
Yeah.
Every single guy says, what I would give to go back just one more time and play in that college campus on that field for that team. Just one more time.
Yeah.
And these guys that are in college, they're trying to get out, and everyone that's left, they all want to come back in. These college players need to wake up and realize that they've got it pretty good.
Well, they're not only trying to get out, but a lot of people around them are pushing, trying to get them out too. You know, I mean, they all want to catch into being the contrail, you know, the B-52, it's really interesting to me. It's really fun because when you're talking here, you know, I get charged up about college football, always have. And I was just, you know, everything you were saying there, people may not have seen it. I was nodding at almost every point you were making. You know, I'm just thinking back, Coastal Carolina, BYU is one of the great games you're ever going to see this past year. You know, both of them were just trying to fight, knocking on the door. Hey, think about us in that Final Four thing. But forget that. It was a hell of a football game, you know? Yeah,
and you know, like it's like Ohio State, for example. If Ohio State makes a run any year.
Yeah.
Remember the year that they ended up coming a little bit short of the playoff and they ended up going to the Cotton Bowl to play USC. And USC, they didn't make it into the playoff either.
Yeah.
And they ended up going to the Cotton Bowl. There was a percentage of fans that were like, oh, my God, what a terrible year. Meanwhile, I think they played Sam Darnold. They ended up beating him pretty convincingly. And it's a great – I don't remember what year it was. What a great –
2017. I think 17, but go ahead. Yeah.
Great team that should be celebrated forever. And we're to a point, they didn't make the playoff. You know, it's almost just like – so I think that we got to step back a little bit on, yeah, we all want to make a playoff. We all want to win the national championship. When you're at Ohio State, you should.
Yeah.
But if you don't make it, it's still okay. Oh, yeah. It's still okay. It's still a great year. And those players are still great players and they deserve 100% support to get behind them. And I just feel like, you imagine if you're Ryan Day, you don't make the playoff, it's a fail. You're a failure.
Yeah. Hey, I talked about that last week, you know, in the last couple of weeks with Paul Feinbaum, for example. I had him on and we were talking about, you know, it's like Final Four or bust. And the bust part, that you know, whether you liked Andy Geiger or not, he forecast this a long time ago because he pointed out the fact that college football is sort of at its guts, at its roots, is sort of a regional sport, you know, in a lot of respects.
Yeah. Yeah.
There are very few national brands, and even the two biggest national brands going, Alabama and Ohio State, you know, the viewership of that game this past year was not – of course, viewership's been down all across the board because everybody's got everything else going for them. But you don't want to throw the baby out with the bathwater cliche here. And everybody's pushing for 4-18 playoff. I go, you know, really, you got to get the 14 thing figured out first, you know, from an interest standpoint.
When we were at two with the BCS, every game, those games in September, everybody was on the edge of their seat. Like, you could say whatever you want, like games matter, they don't matter. In that era, as much as we argued about computers shouldn't be ranking teams, the one thing we all agreed on is if Ohio State opened up with Oklahoma or whoever it might be, it, you felt like, oh my gosh, like this is a huge game for Ohio State or for whoever it might be.
Yeah.
And during the playoff era, you, I mean, yeah, they're big games, but you don't, I don't feel like that same sense of urgency that we had when we had the BCS. And if you go to 8 or 12 or whatever you're going to go to, I don't know. I don't know how we recapture the regular season mattering.
Yeah. My famous point about that is if you go, when you go to 4, you got 2 or 3 teams that claim they should be in it. If you go to 8, there's going to be 8 or 9 teams who think they should be number 8. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I mean, that's, and if you go bigger than that, I mean, whatever, you're going to throw everything else out that's really made college football different. I mean, real, hey, I know you don't have much time. Real quick, I've given you kudos privately and stuff about this before, but I remember when you had the Les Miles scoop way back when. Remember before they were playing in the SEC championship game, and you caught a lot of heat for that. In fact, you were very right from everybody I've talked to about it and stuff, about him going to Michigan from LSU and stuff. What I'm getting to here is, just real quick, he's in a lot of heat now. I'm talking about Les Miles is, and you contrast that with Tom Allen sitting at Indiana. Indiana was probably the second best team in the Big Ten last year. Are you kidding? You know, the Big Ten got flipped upside down except for the team at the top. But just touch on those two things real quick. Les Miles, I mean, how serious a situation do you think this is that Kansas has now put him on leave, et cetera, while they look into problems at LSU? And then Tom Allen, what's your take on that?
Yeah, I mean, the Les Miles thing, only thing I know is probably like you, just from what I've been reading, and goes back to his days at LSU. And
yeah.
Just, you know, it's just sad, you know, to think that, these are allegations at this point. I don't know if there's truth to it or not. The reality is that he's been put on administrative leave for now. Jeff Long, who's the AD there, I don't know if Jeff's going to be okay or not, you know, based on everything you read. But clearly Kansas is, people forget, you go back to 2007. I know that was a long time ago now, but they had Mark Mangino. They were tough, man.
Oh yeah.
They and Glenn Mason, but they have been off the grid for a number. Turner Gill was there. Charlie Weiss was there. David Beatty was there. Les Miles has been there. It's almost like they've stopped playing football for the last decade. I mean, they've been way off. So, I just feel bad. But anytime something like this goes down, I feel awful about it. On the other hand, Tom Allen, if you and I would have said that Tom Allen, when he took over for Kevin, that he was going to get them to this point.
Yeah.
I mean, he didn't have any head coaching experience. He really didn't know the Big Ten that well. And Indiana's always, for me, they've always kind of been like the equator of the Big Ten. You know, they might be at a 5-win season. They might be a 6-7. They're just kind of.
That's a good analogy. Yeah.
And they don't go too far down. They don't go too far up, but they're Kevin did a really good job. Bill Mowry years ago did a really good job with them, but I didn't know that they were capable of putting this kind of run together. And it just goes to show you where, I guess, we are in college football. If you can put a system together and build around a quarterback that has a certain skill set. But I think it's bigger than that. You know, when he stands up at a post-game meeting or a win and he starts talking, Tim, to me.
Yeah.
Some people may roll their eyes and, you know, guys crying, you know, like Dick Vermeil. I think it's genuine.
Oh, yeah, I do too.
And I think the reaction from his players when he talks about how much he loves them, even when they lost to Ohio State, the way they fought back and he stood up in front of them after that game, we are not here for a moral victory. Man, he just seems like a guy I would want to play for. You know, like if you're not a 5-star, like we said, 3 and out to the NFL kind of guy, and you want to go somewhere and be a part of something special, I don't know how you don't look hard at Bloomington. So I don't think this is a blip. I don't think Indiana's going to pat him on the back. Great job in 2020. We'll see you back at the equator in 2021. I don't think so. I think they've been close with Kevin Wilson in the past. They've been close with Tom Allen. And it's the first time they finally got over the hump. And I just don't think they're going to go away. He's recruiting well. He's got a heck of a roster coming back again this year.
Yep.
I think they're paying him well. The facilities have been upgraded like they have been most places in the Big Ten. But I'm a big fan of Tom Allen's.
Give me 10-second take on Jim Harbaugh do they get their act together? I mean, you know, football is such, people don't understand, football is kind of like growing crops. You know, if you get a great recruiting class, you get this early rising, you know, what they call it, winter wheat, you know, and stuff. But what else has kind of come up in that field, you know, through the recruiting and stuff that's going to, you know, materialize or whatever you're going to develop and stuff. And it really looks like Michigan took a big step back last year just from talent standpoint, et cetera. Has Jim Harbaugh, do you think, does he have what it takes? I mean, you know, I know you got to be a little political here because it is, you never know when somebody's going to get it going. Indiana's got it going, right?
Yeah.
But
yeah.
Just in 10 seconds, what do you think? What do you think's coming?
Tell me the last great Michigan quarterback.
Yeah. There you go.
We are today building offenses around the quarterback, and they've been okay, good enough at running back and okay and good enough at receiver and O-line. But they have not been elite at that position. And so we can talk Josh Gattis, we can talk Don Brown and defense, but to me, until you get that spot right, you're swimming upstream. And I just feel like that's the spot that they've got to get right. They've got some new young players are going to be coming up. We'll see. They're basically starting over.
Yeah.
So it's going to be two steps forward, one step back still, but I hope they can get that spot right. If they do, then I think they have a chance to – everything can kind of quiet down for him.
Speaking of quarterback, and we're out of here. This is the last thing. Ohio State's got a derby. He's going to have a derby going on in the spring. If, you know, if spring can any be any semblance of springs in the past. C.J. Stroud, obviously Jack Miller III, Cal McCord, the kid from Pennsylvania. You know, the first two played little, if any, last year in relief of Justin Fields. But C.J. Stroud ended up being, it looked like, number two, at least, you know, when Justin had to go out of the game a couple of times, the kid coming in from Pennsylvania is extremely talented. Just what, I know you keep up with this a little bit because it's your roots. What would be, number one, what do you see coming there? But number two, what would be your advice to these guys? You know, we talked about the book a while ago and the lessons you've learned, et cetera, but what would be your advice?
I would spend as much time as humanly possible with Ryan Day. I mean, Ryan Day, to me, I would put – I travel all over the country. I work with all these guys. Sark right now is a really hot brand. He went to Texas to take over, working with quarterbacks at Alabama. Now he's at Texas. What Lincoln Riley's doing at Oklahoma speaks for itself, obviously. But I think Ryan Day right now, what he did with Dwayne Haskins, who had a completely different skill set than what he's done with Justin Fields over these last 2 years. So – I feel like Ryan Day is becoming one of these quarterback whisperers.
Yeah.
I can't sit here with a crystal ball and tell you about these three guys because all I've ever really seen them in is what you've seen is mop up duty or high school highlights.
Yeah.
I can't wait to see who gets a chance to kind of emerge after spring. That doesn't mean he's the guy, but Ryan Day is going to put whoever that is with the skill that they have coming back at receiver. And I think they're really still going to be really good at running back. You know, early it's going to be don't lose the game from this position, be a distributor, you know. And then I think as the season evolves and you get more experience and more confidence, then you can become part of the reason why you're winning games. But early it's going to be about, you know, being smart, being not turning the ball over, get the ball to the skill guys in space. And then I think as like I said, like any quarterback, you get to week four, week five, week six. Now you start creating, making plays, and letting the game slow down a little bit. But I have no idea who would be – I'm assuming I don't know. You tell me, but it seems to me that the Stroud kid, because he was the backup,
yeah,
more than likely have the early edge. But I think Ryan Day will open it up.
And, oh, he said so. Yeah.
Let these guys, you know, turn it loose and see what they can do.
Hey, indulge me one last thing. I wanted to ask you this earlier when we were talking about you and growing up and getting your confidence and stuff about being on television stuff. You know, Paul Spahn, Moose, is one of my favorite guys. I still play golf with him almost every week. He's one of your favorite guys too. You know, he reminded me of those stories when you first got on. You know, you were doing that late night television stuff on Channel 10, and he would be standing. You wanted him standing right off to your side, right off camera, because you were so – I don't know if nervous is right. I think you're more of a perfectionist kind of guy. You don't want to screw up, right? Yeah. And is it amazing how far you've come from that moment to where now you're sitting next to Corso and he's putting on his headgear. You know what I mean? I mean, just how much did Moose mean to you in those early years?
Every time I go back to Columbus, I see him and I remind him that he's why I'm there.
Yeah.
You know, I never forget the people who helped me. Terry Smith helped me in radio. I didn't.
Yes.
I was a business major. Terry Smith went to bat for me and put me on his show. We started Sportsline in August of 1993. We did 5:30 to 7 o'clock. And I was just a kid, I didn't know what I was doing. And I ended up doing radio for about 14 or 15 years.
Yeah.
But when I moved over to do that wall-to-wall show, I didn't have really any TV experience. Now I'm reading teleprompter. Oh my God, I was terrified to read teleprompter without sounding like this. You know what I mean?
Yeah. With
Jay Crawford, who's such a pro, and he's just bada bing, bada boom, bada bing. And so I had a lot of apprehension, but man, Moose, he was like a mother hen for me. You know, I would be like, oh my God. I was like a boxer that was all freaked out. I'd come into the corner and he'd like rub my shoulders, tell me it's going to be okay. Oh, no, you did great with this. You did great with it. This is going to be great. This is going to be great. He just kept encouraging me and getting me to believe. He was just a great coach. You know his energy. You play golf. You've known him forever.
Oh, yeah.
But he's just one of those guys that just makes you relax when you're with him. And man, I'll never – him and Jay and Dom, all those guys over Channel 10 had so much to do with me just starting out. And Mick, their camera guy, he helped me put my tape together. I didn't have a tape to put together, and Mick Lewis helped me put a tape together where we made it up. You know, I called Eddie George, who just won the Heisman, and Joey Galloway was about to be a first rounder, and I called a little show called Buckeye Corner, which was not even a show, and we did like 10 minutes. I was like, welcome back to Buckeye Corner. And they filmed it in the Channel 10 studios, and we talked for about 10 minutes. We put that on my tape. We went to Ohio Stadium in February when it's freezing, and I pretended with Mick, who's my camera guy, he would act like I'm a sideline reporter. We're standing in an empty Ohio Stadium in February, and I would act like I was a sideline reporter. All right, thanks, Brent. And I would say a report into the camera because I didn't know what else to do.
Yeah.
Moose told me to do those things and put it on a tape, and that's what we did, and we sent it into ESPN and ABC. So, man, they don't go by that I don't appreciate and thank those guys for that time and Moose for his guidance. It was very instrumental for me.
Dude, Moose and I were playing golf the other day. We were talking about you. I mean, you know what I mean? Because, you know, and the thing about it is, almost everybody has to have somebody who believes in them.
Yeah.
You know, Moose believed in you, man. And it was really cool. And so did other guys, you know. I mean, I came on your radio show a bunch, you know, back then. And I totally enjoyed it. But, you know, anybody could see that. Once you got your act together, you were going places. I think maybe it was hardest for you to see, you know?
Yeah.
Here you are. You're writing a book.
Yeah. Well, it was for what I had been through. Now, here's the one thing that helped me is I grew up not listening really to music, but I grew up listening to Andy Furman and Chris Collinsworth as a teenager. So I was always either growing up in the Dayton area in high school. If I was driving, my car had either the Reds on or WLW, you know, even Gary Burbank. Like, I listened to AM radio.
Yeah.
Everyone else is listening to Van Halen and whatever else. And they get in my car and they're like, oh my God, you know, I'm sitting here. But that's what I did. And I think it just made me realize, even as a business major, man, I would love to talk about sports for a living. How cool would that be? And that's kind of what eventually got me started. But you're right, with Terry Smith, without Terry Smith, without Moose and Jay and Dom and all the people, yourself and others that were so helpful, and me just kind of, and I didn't have a plan. It wasn't like, I'm going to go to game day. I was like, I just wanted to do local radio and local TV, and probably would have done that rest of my life, you know, and enjoyed it.
Yeah.
But it just, one opportunity led to another, led to another, led to another. And it happened like, you know, like that. And it was so different back then than it is now. There wasn't Big Ten Network, ACC Network, those are like the minor leagues where you can get some reps. It was just network television and ESPN.
Yeah.
That was it. And there was no like weekly show. It was just game day on the weekend. and games.
No, that YouTube.
That was all there was. There weren't a lot of opportunities out there. That's for sure.
Ladies and gentlemen, Kirk Herbstreit. Kirk, you know, I'll have you on quite a few more times, you know, leading up to the season and stuff. But as we get ready for yet another football season, last year I don't think it was a referendum on anything. I think you guys did a hell of a job. You even went through COVID-19 and came out the other end, right?
Yeah, I did. Yeah. I still can't taste or smell. It's been about 10 weeks.
But, wow. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, what a year for all of us, you know.
Yes.
And hopefully we're getting closer to looking forward to stadiums being full. I'm hearing rumors that people are thinking that there's going to be full stadiums. Can you imagine what that'll be like the first time you go back to the Shoe and there's 100,000 people in there? I mean, it gives me chills. I hope it's this year, man. I hope it happens.
Well, all I know is I'm getting my second vaccine shot in a week. So I'm going to be there no matter what, man. Hey, Kirk, thanks for being on the Tim May podcast, my brother.
Anytime, my man.
As always, I appreciate Kirk Herbstreit coming on the Tim May podcast. Not only does it boost my ratings, but, man, I've always loved talking to Kirk, even when he was not even a backup quarterback, a third string, whatever you want to call it, way back when he was fighting for his spot, you know, to finally make a difference on the Ohio State football team, you know, and something we didn't even bring up then, but awesome. He was the quarterback when they finally broke at least the run by Michigan there, the loss streak to Michigan with that tie, the tie that Gordon Gee said was one of the greatest wins in Ohio State history. You know, even though it was laughable, it definitely made sense if you were covering Ohio State football back in the late 80s and early 90s. But it's always a pleasure to talk to Kirk, right?
Yeah, and I've said that whenever he's been on here to bump you up in that ratings battle that he's so knowledgeable. I know that people have strong feelings about him in a lot of different directions, both in Columbus and nationally, and that generally means that you're doing your job pretty well. If it got one side or the other, that's when ESPN would have to stop promoting him to the moon to do anything that they could possibly find for him to do. But I've always enjoyed talking to him. He was really nice to me when I was at ESPN, helped out wherever he could. I'll never, forget that because I don't have that long-term background with him the way that you do and many others in this market. But great guy. I love his insight. I'm always glad when he's on your podcast.
Yeah, and I think the one lesson that came through once again for folks who want to get into our business or his business, hard work is what gets you there, man. I mean, he was no overnight sensation, went from college football immediately to an analyst on ESPN. He paid his dues, man. Like he talked about, man, when he was in elementary school, he was afraid to even get up in front of the class and give any kind of like talk or speech or even answer questions. And now he does it in front of millions every weekend and stuff. And just, and the homage he paid to Paul Spahn, one of my favorite people of all time, Moose, guy I still play golf with once a week. And how Moose helped him get going and stuff. I mean, it takes a lot of people in your background sometimes to give you a break, to point the way for you. But then you have to finally take the bull by the horns and ride it. And that's what Kirk did. And that's what I give it up to him for. You know, he went through some hard knocks as a kid and even some hard knocks when he got into the profession. But obviously he rose to the front. I think his Emmys are testament to that, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And nobody gets to that level without a lot of help. And I
think, luck.
Yeah. And some people, we know some people who think that they did it all by themselves and act that way and don't pay it back when they have the opportunity to do so. And that's why I mentioned that with Kirk. I mean, I had already achieved something decent in my life to get to ESPN. That was my dream job at that time. But I was starting over and, having to do something else, and there was no reason that he had to help me or giving me any time. I mean, there were a lot of other people that were fighting for that. So I always appreciate that. That tells you a lot about those people at the top, how much they're willing to help and who they'll help and when they'll do it and if there's anything coming back for them or not. So that's, he did that for me and I appreciate it.
Hey, real quick, before we move on to a provocative question, I want to ask you, are not a provocative. I just want to make a provocative statement out there. The reason why I thought it would be great to have a huge crowd to Ohio State spring game this year. Three quarterbacks trying to win the battle. A defense trying to show it can stop passes. Maybe the best now that Devontae Smith is gone. Waddle's gone too, isn't he, from Alabama? Didn't he leave? Maybe the best wide receiving core in the country. Maybe the best tight end in the country, Jeremy Ruckert. Man, this would be – this spring game would be one of those coming up where you just let it all hang out if you're Ryan Day. Just throw 100 passes, right? Because you've got three quarterbacks you want to evaluate on whether they can run the offense, and the offense is as much throwing as it is running anymore. You don't go into those games and try to get running backs beat up because that also beats up your linebackers. You know what I mean? There's all kinds of reasons why this would be the – greatest, one of the great aerial circuses you've ever seen come April 17th. It would be fun to get to see that, wouldn't it?
Without question. And that's, I mean, I've got good optimism that, you know, you and I will at least be able to be in the horseshoe. Hopefully there will be a lot of company in the stands and bring more normalcy. You know, I certainly hope so. We'll see if that happens or not, as I said earlier on in the show. But then you get into one of those timeless debates. If you give up 450 passing yards in the spring game, is that a sign that Ohio State's not getting the secondary fixed, or vice versa? If Seven Banks and Marcus Williamson grab a couple interceptions, does that mean that you've got a lot of problems at quarterback? Somebody has to win those matchups. It does help, I think, that the Ohio State offense would probably be throwing to Chris Olave, Garrett Wilson, Jameson Williams, Jackson Smith and Jigba, Julian Fleming. You know, when you talk, you kind of put a big caveat there. Don't need it. There's no asterisk. This is the best wide receiving group in the country. Yeah. There's no question about that. And I brought this up on Letterman Live on Monday, that, and Nicole Cox did as well, with the stat that, you know, the PFF grades, that number one and number two are Chris Olave and Garrett Wilson. That's absolutely nuts to think about. If you're grading the tandems, obviously Ohio State's got the best one, but they have the two best individuals as well. I can't really remember being around or seeing a team like this, that the embarrassment of riches that they have to throw to, and what that could mean for CJ Stroud, Jack Miller, or Kyle McCord.
Yeah. And it was funny, like you said, if A happens, then B, what's wrong with B? If B happens, then what's wrong with A? I just remember back to Justin Fields 2 years ago, that spring game. You know, he had the great long pass. Who caught that?
Ben Victor.
And it was thrown short, you know, but it turned into – but you're kind of coming out of that game going, my Justin Fields, I don't know, yeah. Now Justin Fields, you know, is going to be taken, I think, earlier than most people expect in the NFL draft, because the NFL draft pre-draft wackiness is picking up steam again. But suddenly people are finding out, Trey Lance, he didn't play at North Dakota State.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Maybe he's not. Maybe he isn't as polished or whatever as we think he is. Let's reevaluate Justin Fields now. That's what we're seeing, right? I mean, remember we were talking about this a week ago about how Justin was slipping. Now Justin is going back up the pole because, you know, Justin Fields, when he had a few, you know, struggles, it was against Indiana, which blitzed coming off the bus. It was against Northwestern when he didn't have his primary receiver there in Chris Olave. And also, as people found out, Northwestern had a hell of a defense this year with some really good defensive players that are going to get drafted. And then against Clemson, he lit up Clemson like it was a Christmas tree. And and he struggled against Alabama. I don't know if struggles. Yeah, he struggled against Alabama, but the Ohio State offense struggled against Alabama when they lost Trey Sermon. But my point is, you've got some ways to evaluate Justin Fields going against big-time competition, not division 1AA, FCS, whatever you want to call it. I think people are finally coming back to their senses. This guy can throw every pass. Plus, he runs very fast when he has to. You saw him get better almost every week that he played football. And I think it's finally, you know, knock on wood, it's coming. People are coming to their senses. Do you agree?
Well, give it about, 22 days, 21 days. And he gets the spotlight for his pro day and every and every network carries it live and sees what he can, you know, sees the physical tools, watches him make every throw. And you'll have CJ Saunders out there to catch some of those passes. which I think is a little bit of a cool story. Ohio State seems to always have like more cool stuff going on with Pro Day that's under the radar than anywhere else. It's pretty uncanny that will be a little bit of a subplot to that. But
like the day Troy Smith.
Troy Smith
there was throwing balls to the receivers, and all of a sudden the scouts are talking to Troy Smith again. It was crazy.
That was crazy. You know, the Pro Day in 2016, which was just an absolute circus when that crazy class was coming out.
Yeah.
That one, this is way off track. I'll tell this story another time, but like Cardale, you know, let me follow him around for the entire day for the 26 Pro Day. So I, you know, instead of the place where we're normally pinned, on the side, I was out there on the field, you know, right behind Cardale, you know, for his going through everything at George Whitfield and all the pro scouts and, you know, all the guys that we always used to cover, and just like talking to him live. Like, they have millions of dollars on the line. I remember Mike Thomas running his 40 and like him asking me what he ran. And I'm like, well, that scout said this. I'm like, I think you just made a bunch of money. Like, that was one of the coolest things I've covered in a long time, just because we're normally just in such a bad spot. But anyway, the point is, that day when the spotlight is on Ohio State and it's in the Woody and Justin Fields gets to show what he can do, it's going to go like this. Trey Lance and, you know, that stuff is just ridiculous to me. Even you look at BYU and the level of competition, I just don't understand it. Doesn't matter, because at some point in what, late April or whenever it is this year, they're going to have to make a decision. And what is a safer bet? Justin Fields is the safer bet. You've seen it at a high level that you talked about,
right?
Competition that they've faced. You know, that would be an insane gamble to be the second or third or fourth general manager and to pass on Justin Fields. I can't see that happening.
Well, you know what? We're going to come back and talk about a lot of things next week. Like I've already teased, though, we're going to talk about Ohio State spring, what we see coming down the pike, but we're going to give a little insight on some really like battles within battles that, you know, guys like me and you pay attention. You know, I'm not bragging. We do pay attention have our eyes on.
Cause that's what they pay us to do.
I know, but a lot of, yeah, exactly. Well, yeah. They pay everybody to do that though, don't they? Anyway, I digress. No, there's some good guys out there. You know that. I mean, but the bottom line is that's what kind of makes or break a football team, you know? Tommy Togiai's coming on. He's going to take, you know, he's going to step in there and take Hamilton's spot. But, you know, who's going to be that other guy, you know? I mean, who's going to I'm talking about, you know, last year. Yeah. Well, it was Haskell Garrett, who gets wounded before the season starts even. Even coming out of the spring, like, well, there wasn't any spring. There were two spring practices. But we were all wondering who that other defensive tackle was going to be. And it turned out to be Haskell Garrett. So that's what you have your eye on. Haskell Garrett's back this year. He's now a leader and stuff. And so who are those guys that we see coming up who could step in and become big-time ball players? I mean, difference makers just throughout the team. That's what you and I are going to talk about. Maybe just for the few people who get to see a little bit of it or at least see glimpses of it, who you should have your eyes peeled for when they're out there, right?
Yep.
But until then, awesome, Ward. Thanks
for
coming
on. Did you want me to tease it?
What?
That was your provocative question. Did you want me to tease it?
No, I didn't want you to tease it. Well, that was enough of a tease. I went long. I went, like I said, I went deep on that one again. The rabbit hole, you know, is a never-ending quest for me to find the bottom of.
Paid silver.
Yeah. Well, there you go. There's one of them, ladies and gentlemen. All I know is that guy gave me tips on where I could find some hay last spring, and I will always be indebted to him for that. I mean,
there you go.
You talk about a multiplicitous individual, that's Cade Stover. So, yeah, we'll talk about him and a bunch of others. But until then, for Awesome Ward, this is Tim May. This is the Tim May Podcast. We'll see you next week.